Hi, Miriam.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Hits TV. You are Miriam Elder, the Guardian, the Moscow correspondent for The Guardian, and you're in Moscow right now. Thanks for taking the time on what is probably going to be a busy day for you, because the news, when I woke up, which was half an hour ago, was that the defense minister of Syria had been assassinated, right? Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, and then there's some discrepancies on whether the interior minister is dead or just injured.
Right. And, you know, Russia's position, well, maybe you can explain to us what Russia's position has been. I mean, they're perceived as kind of the holdout, one of the main holdouts among the, you know, in the international community. In terms of you know, being a little more heavy-handed in ushering the Assad regime out of power, but how does the Russian position look from your point of view?
The Russian position, it's a pretty like fundamental philosophical thing versus something like concrete interests. I would say Russia is just fundamentally against foreign intervention and regime change. You know, they've seen a host of not even client states, but allies lost since the end of the Cold War, be it, you know, Yugoslavia or be it Libya. And now we're seeing the same thing happening with Syria. So I wouldn't say that they're, like, straight out supporting the regime of Assad, but they're definitely against the West deciding what gets to happen there.
Right. And there's been – you wrote a piece that actually somewhat revised the conventional wisdom, I think. I mean, on what Russia's motivation is here. What you often hear – is that Russia is attracted somewhat to the arms sales relationship they have with Syria. They make a little money. And more significantly, they have this this naval base in Syria. And I think, isn't there something uniquely valuable about it? I mean, that had been the conventional wisdom that it's what, their only warm water port or something or other. But you suggested that actually these things don't rank that high in the Russian calculus, right?
Right. I mean, I think they figure into some degree. But you know, again, if you look at the pictures of the port, it's not this massive, super modern structure that the Russians are using, you know, on a daily or weekly basis. It's just this kind of rotting hunk of metal.
Uh-huh.
So, they figure into some degree in Syrian arms sales. Like Russian experts estimate they're around 5% of Russia's total arms sales. And it's important for sure. But I don't think that that's what's their driving motivation here.
And it sounds like the motivation isn't even entirely that, hey, this is our client state and we don't want to lose it. It's more about the general principle of the West, in their view, repeatedly messing with client states or states in general.
Yeah, precisely. And I think the reason they're being so harsh right now is also because of what happened to them or what they see as happening to them in Libya. And what happened there was you had a rare disagreement between the then president, Dmitry Medvedev, and the current president, Vladimir Putin, over what to do in Libya. Do they veto the Security Council resolution or not? And, you know, there's a strong sense here that Putin would never have allowed Russia to behave as it did then, which was just kind of standing aside and letting the vote happen and abstaining. And what they see as having happened there is, you know, they gave their approval to a no-fly zone. And they see it as having been misinterpreted purposefully by the West as a cause for intervention. And I think they're very scared of the same thing happening in Syria. So they're blocking any resolution that doesn't include language explicitly ruling out some sort of intervention.
Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, they're increasingly in a little bit of a pickle, right, in the sense that it's been looking in recent weeks to me as if the regime was clearly doomed and might well fall within the year. And now, after the most recent news, I would only, you know, double down on that, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there's probably a recognition inside the Russian government, too, that that they're going to have to come to terms with that at some point. You know, they've repeatedly said, the foreign minister has repeatedly said that it's not that Russia supports Assad. They're not beholden to having Assad remain in power. So that's already kind of like a version of distancing, you know, or it leaves them wiggle room, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll have to see how they react to the events this morning.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like one path they could have taken and maybe could still take is to take an active role in helping to usher the regime out of power, and in the process, you know, guarantee themselves a role in the future of Syria, you know, and to some extent just save face about it, you know, and make it, you know, because it seems to me now we may be headed for the worst possible outcome for them, where it looks like they tried to defend the regime till the bitter end and they just lost, and because they're not participating in a process of peaceful as peaceful as you could get in terms of a transfer of power, they're not gonna have much say, and I don't see it doesn't look good for them to me.
Yeah, I mean, these are two competing principles, and you know, I'm sure that they've learned the lesson as well from Syria, which is from Libya, excuse me, where they completely, you know, just kind of threw their weight behind Gaddafi the whole time, and they've lost out in Libya. You know, they had some major oil contracts there, and it looks like those are gone. But at the same time, you know, you say they could kind of help usher out the regime and save face, but helping usher out the regime just goes against this very principle of regime change, which from the West they are so against.
There had been some talk of Moscow providing safe haven for Assad and others in his family and the regime. And it does seem to me that a prerequisite for any peaceful transfer would have been guaranteeing him some kind of safe haven and even immunity from international prosecution. But is that talked about at all in Moscow?
No, I mean, there was a report a couple of weeks ago, I guess now. Excuse me. Again, there was a report a couple of weeks ago. And the Russian, I think, deputy foreign minister first, and then the foreign minister came out within a couple of days and said that, yeah, some Western officials had approached them with that, and they laughed it off as a joke. And that was the end of that.
So what, as a journalist covering Russia for The Guardian, in the light of today's news about the assassination of the defense minister and maybe the interior minister, what is your mission? I mean, what kind of angle are you looking to flesh out here today as you go about your reporting?
It's always kind of a double game, I guess, here in Russia. Like, I'll just wait to hear what the official reaction is, if there is any, this quickly. And then one of the biggest problems as a foreigner reporting in Russia is just kind of getting access to the inside official view. So I'll just, I guess, call a bunch of, you know, we call them Kremlin connected analysts who can kind of give insight into what they're thinking right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have no idea how they'll react. It'll be interesting.
And do Kremlin officials play the game, the media game, much the way, say, officials in Washington would? I mean,
absolutely not. It's two completely different views of what the role of journalism is and how you're meant to deal with journalists. So whereas in the U.S., you know, I imagine you have, like, senators' mobiles and stuff like that. That's almost unthinkable here. There's a couple who will talk. But the view inside the Russian government is very much still very closed and kind of just keeping journalists as far away versus, you know, developing relationships and, I don't know, using us, let's say, to leak, like, certain information or something. It just doesn't happen.
Do they, in your view, kind of fail to fully exploit the media? Use you to their ends, you know, establish a kind of symbiotic relationship where kind of you're using them and they're using you the way it works in the West?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best example of that was the war with Georgia in 2008. And all the reports in the beginning, you know, were from the Georgian side. And there were interviews with the Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, all over CNN. He was just everywhere. And reports from the Russian side came only, I think, like 4 days into the war, because the Russians just simply weren't allowing access to journalists. And I know that that's a specific war zone kind of situation, but it's a pretty good example of how the Russians approach the press in general and just the effects of it. So you get the other side, and what happens here in Russia is, you know, we have this growing opposition movement who will talk to us all the time, obviously. You know, they want to get their message out there. They have a more liberal point of view when it comes to speaking with the press, so their point of view gets expressed more because they're more accessible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now this leads, I guess, somewhat naturally into another big story in Russia, which is freedom on the internet. I mean, traditionally, as I understand it, I mean, as of 6 months ago, say, my sense was that TV in Russia and maybe other mass media like newspapers, I'm not sure, was to some extent kind of de facto well controlled by the state or the establishment, such that there was pretty good message control, you know, quite unlike what you would see in America in terms of the government's ability to kind of spin things and influence what people were seeing. But the internet in Russia, even at, you know, as of 6 months ago, was this relatively free place where lots of things were said and it was pluralistic. The only thing was there were a lot of Russians who didn't spend much time on the internet, so mass media was still more important. I mean, old-fashioned mainstream media was still more important in Russia than, say, it is in America relative to the internet, right? So first of all, we'll get into what is now changing about the internet in Russia, but is that a fair summary of the status quo 6 months ago?
More or less, but I would say, TV, the state has almost total control. They have three channels that they control, and mm-hmm. that's the main source of information, particularly outside of the big cities. The second thing with newspapers, there are a couple of free newspapers, independent newspapers, relatively, but because Russia is just such a huge country and the infrastructure is so poor, you know, you get outside of Moscow and it'll take 3 days to get an issue, you know, wow. So I'll get Monday's issue on Thursday. And with the internet, actually internet use is a lot more widespread. I think there was a study that came out a couple of months ago that said that Russia had the highest internet penetration rate in Europe. So I don't know about compared to the U.S. I'm sure it's much, much lower, but in Europe per capita, I think it's the highest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now, the relative freedom of the internet may now get reined in, right? A bill has already passed that would do this, would crack down on the internet?
Right. Basically, what it is it's a law that targets sites devoted to pedophilia, promoting drug use and promoting teen suicide, and that's what it is by the letter of the law. But the problem here is that since the application of laws is so politicized, that there's a very widespread fear inside the country that this is the first step to banning certain websites. So what the law does is it creates this federal register, like a blacklist, and once a site falls on that list, the internet service provider will be forced to cut access to it.
Okay, now the law had been written more broadly, right? The law as originally drafted had been much more of a blank check for censors?
I don't know if much more. It included some language about, you know, like bad sites.
Right.
And then the one apparently big change is that so these sites would have to be shut down without a court order, and now any site that doesn't fall into the pedophilia, suicide, and drugs category would have to go through the courts. But again, you have a very politicized court system, which is just completely non-independent. If the case gets taken as far as the courts, it's very likely that the site will have to be shut down anyway. It just might be a longer process.
So your reading is that although the law sounds like it's actually written pretty narrowly, I mean, you know, pedophilia, drugs, it's pretty easy to say, you know, whether a site is or is not, devoted to promulgating pedophilia. Although the bill is written narrowly in that sense, your sense is that the way the Russian judicial system works is that this still amounts to a blank check to censor a website that's criticizing the administration?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just a thought, it's kind of going on precedent. So already the Justice Ministry here has a list of more than 1,000 websites that are banned inside the country. And the technical charge, the reason that they're banned, is extremism. You open the list and you see sites, you know, offering free music and free movies and just kind of anything that, you know, these things probably maybe should be, I don't know, like just how they're shut down in the U.S., you know, Mega Video or whatever it was called. But they're shut down under charges of extremism. You know, is downloading a Justin Bieber song illegally extremism?
Mm-hmm. So they didn't really need this law, it sounds like.
Well, what this does is it brings it to the federal level. Those were very, like, specific circumstances. And there was just an example today, actually, that came out. There's a town just north of Moscow called Yaroslavl, and a court just declared that LiveJournal, which is the blogging platform that Russians prefer by far. They declared that it was entirely extremist because of one supposedly extremist blog that it was hosting, and they just shut access to it for the whole city.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take this as an example. I mean, the conversation that you and I are having, which will actually be available in Russia. Now, I doubt that Putin wakes up at night in fear that Blogging Heads TV will undermine his regime.
Well, he doesn't use the internet, so...
What's that?
He doesn't use the internet, so that precludes that.
And if he did, I kind of suspect he wouldn't be one of our regular viewers. But I mean, you can imagine. Let's suppose this was Russian language or was translated into Russia, and let's suppose it became actually influential. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you think would be shut down if that were the case.
Could be. It could be. You know, there's no saying. The problem with Russia in general is that laws tend to be vague, allowing, political manipulation. Courts are under the control of the state or of corrupt officials. So it's just kind of this, you know, very messy recipe for doling out revenge to whatever websites or activists or people that, you know, the state feels like it needs to go after.
Uh-huh. Now, there have been these demonstrations periodically in, I guess, mainly in Moscow. And I assume this is, these are kind of, liberals, relatively speaking, who want more in the way of, I gather, free speech and so on. Is this one of the main things the government is concerned about? Is this kind of the barometer it would use to decide how much of an immediate crackdown is in order?
I mean, the protests that we've seen since December, that's what prompted not only the internet law, but last week was the last working week for the parliament, for the Duma, and they adopted a host of laws. And if you take that together with a couple of laws that were adopted in the past month, so fines for protesting were increased astronomically.
And wait, are the fines, how is the law written? I mean, is it like protesting is punishable by fine, or technically, what rationale do they have to kind of drum up to subject you to a fine if you're a protester?
If you attend an illegal protest, you can potentially pay, tens of thousands of dollars in fines.
So every protest requires state authorization, and you can get fined if you go to one that's unauthorized.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one law. Then this internet law, which again is open to interpretation, but you've had the biggest websites in Russia, Yandex, the search engine, Google Russia, Wikipedia, they all came out expressing their concern. There's that. Then there's a third law, which is that all non-governmental organizations that receive grants from abroad are going to have to register as foreign agents, which means that they're going to have to put like tags across their websites and across all their publications identifying themselves as foreign agents. It already sounds bad in English. In Russian, it sounds even more Cold War spy terminology. And so you take all of these together, and you see that it's a way of the government to react to these protests and just to try to rein in some of the political freedoms and the freedom of political expression that we saw, break out in December.
So it sounds like it is the protests mainly that have the government so concerned that it's doing these various things to get control of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it's often described here by different analysts is when Putin first came to power, there was this famous meeting with a bunch of the oligarchs, a closed-door meeting with the oligarchs after he came to power, where he said, "You guys don't get involved in politics, and I won't get involved in your business. Let's just, keep those two things separate." Mm-hmm. And the way that analysts put it here is that that was also kind of an unspoken social contract with society, where it was like, "You guys don't get involved in politics at all, and I'll make sure you live better. I'll make sure your wages get better, and infrastructure will get better. Your life will get better. Just don't get involved in politics." And you just had, seemingly out of nowhere, it took us all by surprise, just this groundswell of political activism and just the death of apathy when Putin announced that he was going to be returning to the presidency. And in the Kremlin, as a result, they're freaked out. They've never had to deal with a politically active populist before.
I see. That was kind of the spark that ignited the protest, was that Putin seemed to want to just stay on forever, and they just said, we've had enough of you?
Yeah. There was a widespread belief inside Russia that he was going to do that. Mm-hmm. But then you had, you know, the mainly Moscow-based intelligentsia and middle classes who were like, you didn't even ask us.
Right. And how narrow is that base of opposition to Putin? I mean, it looks like a lot of people when they get them together in the streets, but, you know, Moscow's only one city and so on. What are they very representative at all of Russia, in opinion, broadly, these critics of Putin?
You know, it's kind of hard to measure because basically what you have is this it is the middle class in Moscow. And in Moscow, you do live a lot better than in the rest of the country. You have a bit in St. Petersburg. But what's happening is, you know, their anger was rising in Moscow. You could kind of hear it, like, among friends and stuff like that. And it just kind of became public in December. But now, you know, when I travel around the country, it's the same sort of thing where I hear that kind of low level of dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. A lot more than I used to when I moved here 6 years ago. But it's not out in the open yet. And then, you know, there are a lot of people who don't seem to actively support Putin. That image of him as, like, the all-knowing superhero has been gravely damaged. But, you know, they think that he's a lot better than any of the other options. And they appreciate, you know, this word that he's promoted himself, which is stability. Russia's been through so much in the past 20 years, not even to speak about, you know, the past century. So they're just happy to have stability.
Mm-hmm. And what is this? Does the source of the discontent differ as you get away from Moscow? I mean, does the basis for discontent broaden? Because, you know, in a lot of these countries where there's been ferment, and including a number that are fall under the rubric the Arab Spring, it turns out that the discontent is by no means only with the concept of authoritarianism, right? Often these are cases where the economy had not been delivering. And in fact, it may be that that's actually, you know, those kinds of discontents are a prerequisite for these movements ever really reaching critical mass and overturning a regime. You know, in Russia, does the basis for discontent go beyond the kind of high-minded liberal objection to perpetual rule by an authoritarian?
Well, I think it's, from what I've seen so far, I mean, the economic cause hasn't, that's not what's brought people out onto the streets, maybe yet. We'll see what happens further. But I was just down in southern Russia where there was really bad flooding just about 10 days ago now, I guess. And it's a variation on a theme, which is this phrase that a lot of people would repeat to me was, you know, are we not people? They felt like the government had just abandoned them. These floods came. There's officials themselves that come out to say that they knew that the floods were coming ahead of time, or potentially, and they did nothing to warn their people. They did nothing to help. And these people just felt kind of thrown aside by their government. That's, to me, a variation on what you hear a lot of the time in the streets of Moscow, where these people just, they feel a lot of the times like they're not being governed. They're being just kind of moved around like chess pieces if they're needed, you know, versus being taken into account as citizens.
And did the discontent over the way the flooding was handled in Krimsk go well beyond Krimsk? I mean, much as the Katrina in America, the Hurricane Katrina thing was, you know, a controversy well beyond Louisiana. Did a similar thing happen in Russia?
What's the most interesting thing actually about the flooding in Krimsk is the reaction among just regular citizens. So you had volunteers flying or driving to the region from Moscow, from St. Petersburg, from Krasnodar, from like cities all over Russia, and just donating like tons and tons of clothes and medicine and stuff like that. I have never seen anything like that before in Russia, and I've lived through plenty of catastrophes here. And to me, that showed that people are beginning to take their fate and the fate of their country a bit into their own hands. They understand that it's possible that the government won't step up like they should, but rather than just kind of sitting and, you know, being like, oh God, this is so horrible, they're actually taking that step to bring their old clothes out of their house, bring it to some gathering point, and shipping it off down south. And that happens all over the country.
And was that itself to some extent mediated by the internet? Was that a thing that couldn't have taken shape so readily without the internet?
Probably wouldn't have happened as quickly. You know, you had volunteers going down there within 24 hours of the flooding. There was really little coverage on state-run TV. There was almost no coverage on state-run TV, aside from, you know, that Putin had flown over the flood region and just showing his view from the helicopter window. But all over Twitter, all over Facebook, all over all those sorts of sites, it snowballed. Mm-hmm. And you had video from the region. And, it definitely brought people together and made them realize the seriousness of what had happened down there, you know, not accepting the government's statements that, it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the public view of the Russian government. We've talked about the Russian government's view of America and kind of what it sees as Western meddling. Can you generalize at all about the public view of America? I mean, how America is viewed in Russia these days by the people?
It's hard to talk of the people as like a, you know, one unit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And here I think I will have to separate the protesters and the protesters and the intelligentsia and, you know, I guess what's normally referred to as the Russian people. I don't know if that's a fair divide or not, but that's what I'll use for now. Among these opposition protesters, they feel themselves to be part of, you know, this Western community, and there's a pretty good view towards America. When you get out more into the heartland, it's a lot more suspicious. You know, you have people who are more fed kind of a daily diet of anti-Americanism through state media.
They are actively fed that by the organs of state through the state-controlled media?
Yeah. I mean, the best example is one of the first things that the government did in response to the protests was, let me go back even further, when the Arab Spring uprising started, you started seeing reports that this was, you know, all organized by the U.S. State Department. And even before that, when you had similar sort of, democratic revolutions or at least pro-Western revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia, the first thing the government said was this was organized by the U.S. State Department. When protests hit Russia starting in December, the government came out to say these were organized by the State Department. You know, Putin said it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And to a lot of the country, these protesters are presented as enemies of the people, as traitors, and behind them stands, you know, the almighty, all evil U.S. State Department that wants to bring Russia to its knees. That's the message that they're being fed.
And do we have any control over that? I mean, are there any things that America is doing that kind of needlessly play into this narrative, or do we just have to live with it?
I'm not sure that America's at fault here. It's the excuse that the Russian government has dreamed up. But a controversial role has been played by the new U.S. ambassador here, Michael McFaul, who, you know, uses Twitter very widely and a little wildly to communicate his thoughts. And but like all ambassadors, you know, spends a lot of time meeting opposition people, because of the access, I think, mm-hmm. that I referred to earlier. And again, should he stop meeting with opposition activists because it upsets the Russian government and allows them to formulate this excuse for their people? Probably not. I don't know. The role of a diplomat is to meet with whomever in the country, but his role has been particularly controversial.
Has he done more of that than past ambassadors?
I'm not sure, you know, in terms of his schedule or whatever, but it was a really controversial appointment because, you know, he's not a career diplomat. He was a professor at Stanford. He's written a couple of books on democracy promotion.
Right.
The Kremlin, he was just kind of the perfect target for the Kremlin, particularly as these protests were breaking out.
And what kind of stuff has he done on Twitter that's gotten attention there?
I'm trying to remember because
I can probably Google it.
But in general, he just speaks very openly. You know, he doesn't. He's not a diplomat. He doesn't talk like a diplomat.
And diplomats aren't supposed to speak openly. I'm sorry, no. But it's part of the job description. I know you've got to go do your reporting, and I'll let you go in a minute. Quickly, maybe just two things. The first is just you used the term oligarch a few minutes ago, and one thing that interests me is the way in Russia, oligarch is almost a formal designation. You know what I mean? It's like you would never see it applied as an adjective in a straight news report to an American, you know, oh, this is one of our oligarchs, you know. But in Russia, you almost get the impression that it's an officially, you know, assigned rank or something. And that just must say something about the way things work over there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's one of these words that also has, like, changed meaning a lot over the past 20 years. In the 90s, there really were oligarchs, if you look up the definition of oligarch, you know, and this was a group of businessmen that basically ran the country. Mm-hmm. When Putin came to power, one of his first things was to take them under control. A lot of them are in exile or in jail now. And the ones who, you know, decided to play by his rules are prospering. But now you have a different group of oligarchs, which is people that grew up with Putin or that Putin worked with. They're like private contacts of his. To what degree do they influence government policy? I don't know. It's, you know, the government is much more secretive now than it was even back then. But yeah, they're close to Putin, and that's, I guess, how we define it now.
Hmm. Okay. So it has, I mean, some of the evolution has been positive.
In Russia or with the
oligarchs? Yeah, in Russia.
Yeah.
And I mean, including the relationship of the oligarchs to government, I guess. I mean, there is a little more transparency than there once was about what's going on with these guys.
I wouldn't say that there's more transparency. Like in general, Russia, there have been improvements in Russia under Putin. Whether they happen because of him or in spite of him, you know, it depends on who you ask. People are living, though, a lot better than they have lived for a really, really long time. You can't overstate just how chaotic the 90s were here. You know, people were on the brink of starving at times. So there is more of a degree of, yeah, this word stability, I guess, that Putin likes so much. But a lot of the improvements have come with concurrent costs. You know, so bringing the oligarchy under control, for example, one of the biggest steps that Putin took to do that was arresting Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who used to be the richest man in Russia. He was the head of the Yukos oil company. Mm-hmm. You know, he's often held up as this, you know, shining light of a political prisoner, and, you know, we can argue about that plenty. But basically what did happen after that is it opened the floodgates, and he's the most famous, but now, according to human rights activists here, most of the people that are in Russian prisons now are businessmen, or let me rephrase that. Most of the prisoners that approach human rights activists about, you know, getting help are businessmen, because what happens is it kind of set this precedent for all low-level officials. Like, you can do this. You can arrest a guy, steal his business, and that's the way it works. And you see that happening on a low level, small and medium-sized businesses, over and over and over again.
So the persecution of the oligarchs isn't so much about kind of reining in free speech or anything. It's just about stealing their business assets, but government officials stealing their business assets.
To one degree, I think it's all about control. I was speaking last week to Masha Lipman, who's an analyst at the Carnegie Center here, and just, you know, she's one of the brightest minds on Russia. And she presented this, like, really interesting theory and just really well phrased about how Putin's whole policy is about control. So when he came into power, he, you know, went after controlling the oligarchs, controlling the media. There were free television channels, again, controlled by the oligarchs, but he needed to have them to be able to transmit the government's message to the people. Mm-hmm. And so his whole thing was kind of bringing, you know, the different sectors of the Russian economy, the media, society, under his control. And what happened with these protests in December is a bit of that control was loosened, and what he's doing now is kind of working to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, just before we go, do you have anything in the way of a forecast? I mean, I know if I ask a question like that, you'll say no. Wise people don't make forecasts. But I guess I'd say, what is your sense for the direction things are heading in? I mean, it sounds like I mean, I take these recent kind of crackdowns, you know, on the internet, to some extent, I guess, on foreign entities that might have websites in Russia as well. I take them to be signs of insecurity, you know, signs that there's the regime perceives to be serious threats domestically in the form of the protest movement, right? Do you have any sense for how this might play out, or just how concerned the government should be?
My sense is that we're heading probably to some kind of a standoff, because you've had not a huge segment of the population, but an influential segment of the population mm-hmm. has woken up. This is the terminology that's been adopted here. So they've woken up. Will they go back to sleep again? It's unlikely. On the other hand, you have a government that has just begun to show how concerned it is by adopting these pretty repressive laws. So they're kind of like, you know, up against one another right now. It's summer now, so things are calm, but we'll see what happens in the fall. I can't see it continuing sort of at this level of tension indefinitely. It's totally possible. You know, the one rule in Russia is expect the unexpected. But I don't know. I think that we're... I don't know. I don't know. Maybe some kind of a standoff, but I don't really know what form that would take. I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's you have adopted the wise position on forecasting the future. Profess no idea whatsoever.
It's a safe one.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for taking the time, Miriam, and what I gather is a day that should be winding down now, but thanks to events in Syria, is probably not over for you by a long shot. I'll be looking for your what you write about the Syria thing in The Guardian, and we will link to your many other excellent Guardian articles on the site here so people can read them. And I hope we'll be able to do this again sometime.
Yeah, great. It was really interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.